So one thing that I love that Susan Friedman pointed out about BAT is that we always protect the exit route. So that's something that we're really mindful of in BAT. And so as we do allow the dog to be in more and more sort of scary situations, you could say, or more and more realistic situations, because we think that they can handle it, we always make sure to preserve that exit route.
Hey everyone, in this episode I chat with Grisha Stewart, the founder of the well-known protocol for reactive dogs, Behavior Adjustment Training. We talk about how BAT has evolved, when it can be incredibly useful, and how it can be integrated with other strategies for other problem behaviors such as when a dog is showing true predation, or as we called in the episode, when a dog is actually having fun. And this episode is sponsored by AggressiveDog.com. where you can find a variety of educational offerings with a focus on helping dogs with aggression, including the Aggression in Dogs Master Course and the Aggression in Dogs Conference, a 3-day virtual event happening from October 2nd to 4th, 2020, with 10 amazing speakers, all experts in their field. You can find out more by going to thelooseleashacademy.com. Hey everyone, I'm Mike Shikashio, and I'm here with the enthusiastic and talented Grisha Stewart. She is a dog trainer, author, and international speaker based in Oregon, USA. Her specialty is mental wellness for all beings, including dogs, dog socialization, and reactivity. Her behavior adjustment training, BAT, BAT, technique is used worldwide to help dogs gain confidence and social skills. She's always been a teacher. She earned a master's in mathematics to become a college instructor, but she found her true passion in helping people and dogs. She's been teaching dog training and behavior in person since 2003, started traveling worldwide to teach dog trainers in 2010, and also added an online school in 2014. She focuses on force-free methods to promote the well-being of dogs and their humans. And I can personally speak on Grisha's part that she's somebody that I've followed for quite a while and somebody I've learned a lot from. So I'm excited to have her on the show. Welcome, Grisha.
Thanks, Mike. That's a really lovely intro, the second piece. I was more aware of what was going to happen in the beginning of that, but glad that we can mutually
talk about
teach.
That international travel, too. Like, we've both been following each other around. I'm going to talk about kind of fill the audience in on something else later on. But let's jump right in to talk about the evolution of BAT. And I've been following it. I think, actually, the first time I saw you talking about it was on the APDT list, and you were kind of poking around at some ideas there, and it's evolved over the years, and it's not been without little bits of controversy here and there, as many things in the dog training world are. Yeah. Let's talk about the evolution, where it started, how you got into it, and then where it is at now.
So basically I got into BAT when I started watching, you know, all of the things that I could and learning all the things I could about reactivity, not just for clients, but for my own dog, Peanut. And one of the things I came across was a technique that used distance as a reinforcer called CAT. And so I was experimenting with that technique, combining it with the things that I knew. And very quickly, because I'm not a really good recipe follower, very quickly I started saying, well, what if I took out this piece? Because in CAT, the dog was tethered, and there's all these little aspects that I thought, well, do we have to do it this way? And so it shifted from a technique that was using distance as a reinforcer to what BAT is now, which is it's not really reinforcement based in the sense that it's not the trainer giving a reinforcer. It's the trainer setting up a situation in which the animal can experience naturally occurring reinforcers. And that's a huge difference, because that means that we're not deliberately putting them into an aversive situation and then waiting until they do something that we want before we take them out. So that technique then, originally was very structured. So we would approach a dog or the trigger, whatever the trigger might have been, wait for a signal, some kind of disengagement, mark that, and then walk away. And now it's become a technique that's really about creating a way for the dog to feel safe. So we want the autonomic nervous system to be calm enough that the dog can then make good choices. And by good choices, I mean that the dog is choosing to either engage in a social and friendly way, or they're choosing to go find something else to do. They're gathering information and they're moving on. So it's not, the sort of step-by-step, we approach to the line that the human says, so much as the human is there as a parachute to make sure the dog is feeling safe the entire time.
So it feels a lot more organic now than when you first started out and how it's evolved.
Exactly. And it's funny because one of the first DVDs that I made was called Organic Socialization, and that was about Wattbat 1.0. And if looking back, I would now call that maybe like non-GMO socialization. we're basically at a full organic now. So allowing for curves, allowing dogs to choose what's healthy for them, and really nurturing this sense of resilience. We had talked about resilience a little bit in the pre-talk that we were chatting. And I think that really is what BAT is about, is teaching dogs that they can explore a situation and know how to respond appropriately. So we're not teaching them that everything is safe, but rather what to do about it.
Yes. So let's kind of get a little bit into that, the geeky side of things, and kind of explain what's going on now in terms of what's happening from a learning theory standpoint. And is it desensitization? Is it negative reinforcement?
So I've had long talks with Susan Friedman about this because, she's like the guru of all of these terms, and making sure that I have it. And so if you think about her humane hierarchy, or not the humane hierarchy, she doesn't want to call that anymore, just the hierarchy of intervention. That chart is talking about ways that we apply the, so things that we do to the dog, essentially, so interventions that we put in place, and versus something that's sort of naturally occurring. And so the negative reinforcement that does exist in BAT, there's some of it, is called naturally occurring reinforcement. And there's also naturally occurring positive reinforcement. So essentially so naturally occurring reinforcement means that it's in the environment, the timing is based on the environment. It's just that the animal sees an opportunity for reinforcement, does their behavior, and gets it from the environment. So it's not the trainer saying, aha, I'm going to look for this behavior and give a consequence at that time. So it's very different. And we want to maximize reinforcers for all of our learners. And naturally occurring reinforcement is one of those kinds of reinforcement we can maximize. We cannot get rid of the aversives in the environment. They are there. What we can do is teach dogs to be comfortable with them so that they aren't aversive anymore. And so with BAT, there's a process of desensitization, and it's not that systematic in the sense of we go to this foot and then this foot and gradually closer, but it is systematic in the sense that we're looking for low arousal throughout the process. And so there's systematic desensitization in there. There's that operant piece that comes from naturally occurring reinforcers. And that could be the dog moving away from something, which would then be, if they were avoiding it, would be a negative reinforcement, a naturally occurring negative reinforcement. Or it could be that they're moving on. So they were just satiated. They had the information that they needed, and they found something else that was more interesting. So that's a naturally occurring positive reinforcer.
Susan is really great at making sure you're using the right vocabulary. She's somebody I'm definitely very careful about when I'm saying things around, because she's very specific with her terms, but she's so good at it, and she makes you think.
She does, and she's so precise, and I feel like when I attend one of her talks that I want to write down all of the sentences, because I know that she crafted them very specifically.
Yes, she's certainly a brilliant person with that, so in every which way.
You
mentioned that these naturally occurring reinforcers. And what about when you hear that argument that, you're out there with the dog, so technically you're still exposing the dog to these, aversive stimuli. So whether it's other dogs or people that you're working around, what's your answer to that?
So my answer to that is twofold. One is that the purpose of being there is to make them more comfortable. So it's not like the sort of negative reinforcement that's on the chart, which is to try to get other behavior. It preserves that aversive as still an aversive. Choke chains remain aversive throughout the process of training. It's very different from being exposed to something like another dog. And that's one piece of it. The other piece is that there are no procedures that avoid seeing the trigger. So we can't put the dog in a Zoom call and just have them imagine seeing other dogs, you know, why don't you lay on the couch and we'll talk about it. Even that would be exposure, right? So it would still be exposure to an aversive. It would just be mental if we could manage it somehow. I have actually thought about using a projector for that. Anyway, so the other piece, so I said two things, but there's three, which is that this is part of everyday life. So we are arranging a setup, but the setup that we're arranging is easier than everyday life. So it's not that we're adding an aversive. We're actually creating a scenario that's similar to real life that has less aversives in it than real life does.
Right. And so it's our job as the trainer to set that antecedent arrangement for the best possible success for the dog. Right?
Exactly. Yes. And thank you for using that term as well, because that's something I can riff on too, that is about antecedent arrangements. It's creating the scenario that causes the animal to feel safe. And so in terms of that least intrusive protocol hierarchy, we're kind of up there as well, because we are specifically arranging antecedents.
So shifting from there, one of the questions I get a lot is, your dog's barking and lunging on leash towards something. How do you differentiate between frustrated or fear or anger, or the dog just kind of doing it for sport, which we'll talk more about in a minute, but how do you tell the difference?
I used to care more about that when my protocol was specific about I would approach if they did this or move away if they did this. And now I'm really looking in the moment of how the dog, where do you want to go right now? And so if it's frustration, sometimes they want to move forward, but sometimes they'll want to move away. So we don't have a specific protocol anymore for which way they'll go. We're looking at the dog body language in that moment and using that to decide which way we go. But in general, if I was to choose or to try to parse those out, frustration, usually it's a higher pitch bark. The body is usually, you can see more forward motion. It's less, like fear is usually like they go forward a little bit and then they bounce away. It's sort of like their center of gravity is backwards. So you can tell that that's technically where they want to go, even if they might be sort of lunging forward. The kind of standard, you know, the ears in frustration are usually, ears tend to point in the direction that dogs want to go. So with frustration, they might be sort of up-ish, up, or they might actually sometimes be back, because a lot of frustration is really they don't know what to do in that scenario. It's not just that they're wanting to go play. It's often just another strategy to deal with their stress. So to go there and say hello, it's like a compulsive greeter almost, that they're doing that as a way to alleviate their distress. And so with that, we're really trying to make it so that the arousal level is low so we can introduce this pause between stimulus and response. And so in terms of aggression, so actual aggression is that the dog, you know, intention to harm. And so with that, we see, you know, much more severe body language, more stiffness, more freezing, the whites of the eyes, that kind of thing. Even those can be just a warning for for the aggression and not truly an intent to harm. But in a way, for me, it doesn't quite matter, because I think once we reduce the arousal, we get so much more appropriate behavior. And then we can give them experiences that nourish that kind of interaction.
What about dogs that there's no history? So oftentimes, you know, as behavior consultants, we are often going through history, and that's going to give us a lot of information. You know, what's the past interactions look like? Well, let's say, and especially now, we're getting a lot of these where dogs are recently adopted, and you've got a dog that's barking and lunging at leash towards other dogs, and you ask the client, you know, what's the dog like with other dogs? What's the history? Well, then they shrug their shoulders. I'm not sure, because they've never been around another dog and they don't know, but they're afraid to actually do any kind of introductions. So what's your answer there? Or how do you assess that?
I sometimes will use fake dogs. So for example, having a fake dog standing and allowing the dog to go up and greet. I used to have the fake dog be sort of animated by a human, and that turned out to not be a safe protocol. So we don't do that anymore. So we live and learn. But so that's one thing. The other is just in the doing of the bat setup, I can usually see, I can see their behavior. It's just, instead of it being at volume 100, it's at volume 10, right? So you can see approach, you can see more social behavior. So I don't necessarily always know when I go into a bat setup how they would be responding. If I don't have history, though, in terms of their biting or any of that, then when we do the greetings, that's going to be with a fence in between, or I would have conditioned the muzzle by that time so that I know that it's safe for the dog.
Right. Right. Makes sense. It's very similar to what a lot of other the people that do dog-dog interactions. Yes. So, you know, what about this small segment of dogs that are kind of doing this for sport? So they're from particular backgrounds where they've been for dog fighting, or they maybe are bred or purpose-bred for that particular activity and have somehow gotten into a somebody's hands where maybe not realizing that. And what do you do there? And what's the approach there if where you were to use bat or not, or look at something else?
Mm-hmm. So I would still be using bat to some extent because I do the bat leash skills and the concept of relaxation in situations with all dogs. But I would also be trying to have an additional reinforcer, because right now, if they are doing it for fun, which is super rare, as you know, and I just want to double down on that and say that most people think their dog is doing it for fun, and then it turns out it's not. But anyway, so there would be then a reinforcer in the environment if the dog is doing it for fun, so attacking the other dog. So for example, if I'm working with squirrels as the trigger, it's pretty much the same, right? Because chasing the squirrel is fun. And we would want to make sure that the student dog, rather the helper dog is safe. So definitely making sure that there's fences and barriers and all those fun things, but also providing additional reinforcers for the dog. So we would want something that has a similar function. So for example, if, just like if it's a squirrel, if it's, you know, they want to go and bite the other dog, then I would be using something that they could bite onto and then gradually shift it over to something that's not that. So shifting it to a reinforcer that's more mellow, but at first have something that has a similar function and be reinforcing disengagement or attention toward the handler. And also in those cases, I wouldn't expect for a dog to, and now it doesn't mean that they would never get to that point, but my sort of general plan would be to not expect that the dog is going to get to be just social with other dogs, as particularly dogs that they don't know. So my goal for that dog might be that they can avoid other dogs, but not that they're going to be, you know, hanging out completely unsupervised with the family chihuahua.
Do you often go more operant with those dogs, meaning that you're giving them much more direction and cueing of desirable replacement behaviors?
Yeah, I do. And in that case, and also in the case of frustration. So in both cases, the dog already has a reinforcer in the environment. I'm less concerned about making sure that they're feeling emotionally, you know, not afraid, because I'm not seeing as much fear or maybe none. And so what I want is for them to be in their thinking mind. And a lot of times when we're working with fear, I try to make sure we're not in working mode so the dog can truly assess the situation and decide that they're safe. I will put them in, so with dogs who are more frustrated or who are, having fun or predatory, as well, in both cases of that, I would, be doing more operant. However, I also think that if we really want them to notice the subtle nuance of communication, that we need to get rid of that sort of constantly, you know, bossing them around idea. So it's also possible to be around well-socialized dogs who could sort of teach them alternate behavior, you know, not just us. So if you have a dog who's bigger, stronger, and also super mellow and calm and doesn't, you know, isn't going to be the kind of dog that the dog is attacking, then that you can have modeling, social facilitation, for example. So that your dog is kind of at a, you know, a distance on leash or whatever, but having them interact with, or having the helper dogs interact with each other. So we're allowing that to be to be seen, right? So you're going on a pack walk, for example, where the other dogs are interacting appropriately, and this dog who's just sort of attacking for sport is observing but isn't doing that. And I would posit, though, that most of the time, like, even in those cases where it seems to be for sport, much like humans in prison, it's not actually fun. Like, yes, maybe, I mean, there's a super small percentage that just biologically are very different. Most cases, it's trauma. And you can get to the root of trauma by feeling safe.
One of the interesting things is just how well other dogs can really facilitate learning with this particular issue, especially. And you know, I guess the trouble is finding those dogs. Sometimes I'm sure a lot of listeners right now are saying, you know, how do I get those dogs? And it's not always an easy task, and that's understandable.
Especially now when we're all, like, socially distant.
Right, right. And not a lot of people are volunteering their dogs either for that kind of
like task, oh, your dog, you know, wants to kill my dog, not just afraid. Okay, sure.
So kind of moving on through that is, like, when you get to this step, so let's take the heat-seeking missile dog off the table, but rather more towards back to the fearful or frustrated dogs. How do you know when they're ready for, like, socially integrating? So the goal is, you know, we're going to get your dog not to react at a distance, and then we're going to get closer. What are the steps to moving to, okay, let's get these dogs playing in a field together? Or what's this, what, how do you move from that transition to that, I should say?
Mm-hmm. So I'm actually going to circle back, because I just, as you said, the term heat-seeking missile, that I wanted to also say that there are dogs who are actually quite appropriate socially within their own group, and then appear to be sort of aggressive for fun or status or whatever else to dogs outside of their group. And so even though I said that, you know, the prognosis is low for being social, it may certainly be possible that they can be good within their own social group. But be really mindful when there's a change. So if someone passes away, or, you know, something in the household changes, I would be really mindful that it doesn't regress in that situation.
Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that. That does happen. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Just like us, right? When our life situation changes, you know, things change. So, all right. So, but back to your other question then, which is what's the kind of step-by-step of that, as it were? Is that basically, or how does the case progress?
Yeah. So how do you go from, like, okay, the dog's on leash and we've got the dog at a distance doing well, and then we feel like it's ready for the next step. Let's get these dogs together. That's the goal.
Got it. And so, basically, so one thing is I try to get people to step away from a goal idea, because when it's human driven, we almost always do it at the wrong time. And when it's, oh, it looks like the dogs want to greet and both dogs are happy about it, then we can start to be going closer. So with that, we're not going up to a predetermined kind of distance. We are we're observing the dogs the entire time. And so very often within the first session, but sometimes the second or third with a decoy dog, will be to the point where they would do greetings and potentially then even be off leash together. So the amount of time it takes to make a new friend gets faster and faster. And so I'm describing what the first friend would look like, right? So later it kind of ends up looking like, oh, look, there's another dog, unclip the leash, they go play, right? So that's kind of our final picture. Our early picture is you've done a bat setup for 45 minutes. You can tell at the end they were, you know, 10 feet away, pretty interested in each other. Then next time we think, well, maybe they can say hello to each other. So, because we can't stop our human brain from having some sort of a goal. We don't set a goal of that. We just say, you know, it would be great if they did. The next time we would still be then starting off at a distance, doing our walking. A lot of times nowadays with my bat setups, I do moving setups. So it's not that one dog is stationary and the other one is moving, but they were both basically going on a walk together, usually with the student dog in the back. But then we also then want to switch it back and forth, so they end up being in the front some of the times, because that's hard too. So once I've gotten to the point where they've been in the front, they've been in the back, then we start to allow shorter, super short greetings. So they go in for a sniff. So now the helper dog is in the front, the student dog is in the back. the student goes in for a sniff. At that point, I would be using mark and move. So mark and move is when we mark usually with a clicker, we move away, and then we give a treat. And so a treat could be a toy, but some kind of a reinforcer given by the handler. And the reason I use a clicker there is because it's really salient. So it's very likely to get the dog to move away with you compared to just like a yes or something like that. So right when they are in there sniffing, we click, we move away, we treat. You could also give a recall cue instead. That's totally fine. And then allow them to go back in to greet. Now at that point, because usually both dogs were walking, when I click, the helper dog stops and we move away. Otherwise, then they're really far away from us. So maybe they'll go 5 or 10 more feet, but like cue them in advance to not like keep walking. So then we catch up again. We might get another sniff. And so at first, it's these like nanosecond sniffs that we're clicking for, maybe 5 or 6 times of that. And then we start to delay, like we forgot to click, right? We're shaping duration. So half a second later, then we'll click, move away, treat. And then another 5 treats later, we'll shape it up again. So 1 second, 2 seconds. And once we get to the point where the dog is sniffing, turning away completely on his own, and usually that's within, you know, 15, 20 treats, then I stop doing the treats. And so they disengage. I might just say yes and move away. And so just do a little bit of that for a while. And part of that is to deliberately reduce the behavior of doing this as a trick, that they're sniffing and then turning away as quickly as they can. I want dogs to get information when they're in there sniffing. And so I want them to assess safety more than just saying, oh, I get something good from this. I want them actually saying, I'm safe here. And that's when social skills start to bubble up. So I deliberately do go through the shaping process kind of as fast as I can to minimize the treats. And then basically, we do mark and move, but without the food. And then, as I just said, and then I switch to then not necessarily marking, but just following the dog. So if the dog disengages, they may just turn their head, but they may go off to the side a little bit. And so I'm going to follow that. And then just allowing that free movement. At some point, then I would shift into allowing the helper dog to sniff the student dog. And I might need to do that with a fence in between. We might have needed to do the previous version with a fence in between. But just gradually getting, you know, face to rear, face to face, all of the different ways that two dogs can approach each other, and taking breaks in between. So we might go 5-10 minutes, take a break, go explore another area together, come back, because that reunion is also a really good learning point. And then at some point, and usually if I'm going to have them go face to face, I've trained a muzzle in advance, or they don't have a hard bite history. They might have air snapped, but they've never made contact. Then I might not condition a muzzle. If it's a client, I usually err on the side of conditioning muzzles because they're not very good at reading body language consistently. And because we often see like the tip of the iceberg, right? So, right. You know, that, you know, the 5 times that they did something, they didn't bite, but maybe that other time there was a firecracker in the background at the same time, and now we're going to get a hard bite. And so, yeah, so I err on the side of safety.
So can you talk about a little bit about how important it is for what the handler is doing in those kind of scenarios, and, you know, just, you know, how much they're moving or what they're doing with the leash or what they're doing with their voice?
Yeah. So the handler in that time is, so I usually have the leashes attached to the back of a harness so the dogs can choose which way they want to go. If I'm really concerned about being able to pull them out of trouble, if they really had trouble, then either A, I wouldn't be doing it yet, or B, then I might be attaching to like the front of a harness. But that can cause trouble because they can get more tangled on that. The handler is making sure to stay calm. They're breathing. If they feel nervous at any time, they can call the dog and move away. And because of this process, we're also desensitizing the handler. So they've had experience of going in, coming out, going in, coming out. And so their stress level is also lower. My clients are trained enough in the leash to be able to use the long leash during this greeting. But if I'm worried at all, then they'll be using a short leash. the benefit of the long leash is that the handler can actually go farther away and sort of stretch the magnet, stretch the rubber band that exists between a dog and their person. So as they start to leave, the dog's like, oh, she's leaving. But there wasn't any extra tension on the leash. They just are able to leave. So you kind of let the leash slide really easily through your hand.
Yeah, I think that's really an important point, too. It's one thing I recommend to my clients, too, is that one of the best things you can do if there's any sensing of problems happening is move away. Don't move into them. That's our natural inclination. Right. They're like, no, and we're jumping in and screaming.
The dog's like, okay, panicking. I've got backup now.
Yeah. So, yeah, happily call them, move away is often the best way to intervene there. So,
exactly. Let's, a treat party is something that we use as our emergency recall.
So let's shift a little bit to how you use BAT for other aggression issues. And I see this a lot, like, you know, it's gotta be nice to have that, you know, the BAT acronym as like a verb in the dog training vocabulary, but I do see it used kind of, cast a wide umbrella over a lot of different issues. So there's, let's have you speak about, like, you know, somebody saying, I use BAT for resource guarding, I use BAT for this, I use BAT for that. So what aggression issues, since we're talking about aggression in this podcast, is what would you use BAT also for? So not just like dog-to-dog reactivity, you know, putting the air quotes up, dog-to-dog reactivity or dog-to-human reactivity. What else do you see it applied well
with? So in terms of aggression or reactivity, could I do both?
Let's go with overt aggression. Dogs
overt aggression.
Bite Got things.
Okay. So then in that case, pretty much in all of those cases, I would be using some BAT, but then I would be using additional protocols on top of that, depending on what's needed in the case. So the reason I would be using some BAT is that I feel it empowers the dog. It reduces their kind of baseline stress level in most cases. And I say most cases because there are some herding breeds where you might need to give more direction. And so you'd still be using something BAT-like. You might be using the long line in similar ways to BAT. You might be, following them at times, but you also might be leaning more to the side of giving direction if the dog seems to need it. But in the case of predation, for example, which we talked about a little bit, but I would be using, I wouldn't just be relying on naturally occurring reinforcers, because the biggest naturally occurring reinforcer is right there and you don't want them chasing after it. Although I might be using Premac in addition, right? So if it's chasing a squirrel up a tree, then I might safely wait till the squirrel's up the tree, get a really good watch me, and then let them go to the base of the tree. But because they're on a long line, I can do that, right? We can run together. I pretty much always walk a dog on at least a 15-foot leash. I've switched over to a 20-foot for Zuki now that I have only one dog. It's super easy now. I'm like, oh, it's great. It's the upside of losing a dog, unfortunately. So that's one thing as for predation. Resource guarding, it's so simple to do resource guarding with an operant procedure of just marking alternative behavior that I don't necessarily need to use BAT for that. I might be using it in sort of the rest of the dog's life, or I might be using some of it if they're resource guarding the handler. I might be using some there. But generally speaking, I just do a protocol where I'm teaching alternate behavior. So, you know, differential reinforcement of alternate behavior. And so, for example, if a dog is guarding a food bowl, you can teach them to either look up when you approach, or you can teach them to use their nose to push the bowl toward you. I'm a huge fan of having them bring whatever they're guarding to the person that's approaching. So it's not just I'm moving away from it and you can take it, but actually here it is, you can have it.
Oh, that's super interesting. Yeah, that's a different, especially with the food bowl, nudging with the food bowl. I haven't seen that one before.
Yeah, it's super handy. It's a little more, like, it takes a little more technical skills to be able to do it, right, to train that. But lots of trainers do have, you know, targeting and pushing skills, or you know, skills for teaching that. Other types of aggression.
What about handling?
Pain-based aggression, yeah, obviously, yeah. You know, deal with the pain. Mm-hmm. But I would be using BAT in with that if it's a chronic pain, because, you know, BAT is all about having the animal assess, what do I need right now to you know, feel at homeostasis, right? And so if they need to move away from something because they're in pain, then, you know, BAT would be useful for that.
So it's, in a sense, a desensitization when you're doing that as well. So let's say we've resolved the pain and there's still lingering behavior side, we're using desensitization, but also again empowering the dog to make the choice to move away and being reinforced for that, right? So it's very similar, and that's a very good application of BAT for that. Interesting, because I hear BAT use a lot, or LAT, or a lot of the acronyms, and I think it's important to really understand from what's happening from the science standpoint, from the learning theory standpoint. But I do feel it's also really important to have these kind of protocols out there, because it kind of lays a framework and it helps people understand, you know, a certain type of protocol or way of doing things in a sense. It kind of gives them a recipe. And I know you don't like the word recipe or want that.
That's apply. Okay.
But I think it's important. It's like, you know, because people really knock the dog training side of things when it comes to like hearing a particular protocol, like, oh, that's just desensitization. Well, yeah. But, you know, there's things like CrossFit and Pilates, and nobody knocks those things about.
Like, oh, that's just fitness. Goal. Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's important, I think, these kind of protocols. So it's, yeah.
Well, and if you look in psychotherapy, for example, there are lots of different specific techniques and procedures, but they all rely on very similar, you know, underlying science, right? So just because I haven't invented new science doesn't mean that the procedure itself isn't different. So it's an operationalization of the things that we know. And in fact, it should be sort of a good thing that it uses science that we already know.
Yes. Yeah. And you're helping teach the science, because people
That's
learn
right.
what's going on. You explain what's going on, and then they go over and see Susan.
Exactly. One of the best things I ever heard about BAT just was very heartwarming. When I was teaching at Clicker Expo, and Ken Ramirez was on the panel after the BAT seminar, after I did this sort of evolution of BAT workshop. And he said, you know, he was familiar with BAT before, he already knew the procedure, but something that occurred to him during the seminar was that BAT actually teaches people how to communicate with their dogs. That's essentially is what it's about. So I'm like, yeah, actually it is.
Not a bad compliment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll take it.
I'll take it. Thank you.
I'll take anything Ken says, really, though.
Right? So. Yeah. I can hear him talk all day.
Let's talk about resiliency now and what that means, because I know it's very important in your world and mine, but it also, there's a lot of applications that BAT has in building resiliency. So go ahead and drop some knowledge on that.
Well, let's see. So resilience is, you know, the ability to handle all of the things that life can throw at us, so that there's a bounce back. If they did get stressed, that the amount of time it takes for them to stop being stressed goes down, that they have coping strategies to be able to deal with something. And kind of the flip side of resiliency to me is joy, that they're able to experience joy. And I know that this is, you know, we can't really ask the dogs like, where are you at on the joy meter here? But, you know, based on body language and based on the fact that they're interacting with other dogs and, you know, and welcoming their species again, I could consider that joy. And so that is, it builds the resiliency by, I would say, by giving them practice in assessing situations. So they're, let's see, I'm trying to think of the right terms for polyvagal theory, but essentially that there is this system that assesses, am I in danger? And so the rehearsal of BAT is this slightly novel situation, am I in danger? Nope, I'm just not in danger, and here's how I cope with it. I have behavior of what I can do. Another slightly novel situation, oh, again, I can cope with this. And I find that BAT is, it generalizes better than when I was doing straight classical conditioning with here's a trigger, here's a treat, here's a trigger, here's a treat. It generalizes a lot better. The dogs remember in a completely different situation, they remember the trigger. So I would find that it's like they almost had amnesia, that they could meet one trigger and then the next day they could meet the trigger again. And because they were like, I'm thinking of my dog Peanut in this particular instance, because he wasn't actually paying any attention to them. He was getting like the barest piece of information before he turned back to me for his treat, that he wasn't actually learning about the triggers. He was just learning kind of one predictor of the food. And what I want is for them to really suss it out. What do they smell like? How do they move? You know, how do you interact with them? And that skill building, to me, is what builds the resiliency.
Yeah, it's so important, I think, in the work I do as well, is giving that dog the choice and control of the environment by allowing them to make those choices. And builds that resiliency. So, and the barometer for that for me is really its behavior, not only body language, but looking at behavior and their responsiveness to things in the environment and how they're responding to those things. That for me is for my way of assessing, where's the dog's stress level at. So body language is important, but also behavior and kind of measuring that against the data that you've had in prior sessions. But I've found, as well as you have, is just that choice and control can really make a significant difference for that dog in helping them build resiliency. Would you agree with that? Or
Absolutely. Yeah, yes. Yeah. And something that I just thought of while you were speaking as well is that, so I talk a lot about, not having dogs in kind of working mode when we're doing bad, right? So we want the dogs to notice the environment. But I also, the benefit of the fact that we're not using treats very much for BAT is that we can actually have them in working mode for almost a completely different set of behaviors. So I could be teaching heel on a walk, but then kind of be batting triggers as well, if that makes sense. So there is a blending. Like once you really have the idea of BAT, you can fluidly switch between the different ways of approaching it. And I also might do straight sort of operant counter conditioning with food for a while and then switch back into BAT. It just depends on what they need in that specific situation. Especially if I'm indoors, for example, I might do some of that and then go back into BAT. If the space is too small, I'll do either just straight classical, or not straight classical, but more operant, click for behavior counter conditioning. Or I might do more a mark and move version of that if I could.
Right. So there's a lot that goes into a session. And, things that got me thinking, too, is that it all starts to blend together, though. When you start putting these pieces together, these pieces of how dogs learn and what they need. And, I was thinking, I just recorded a podcast with Emily Strong and Ellie Bender on enrichment and just how important that plays a role in things. But then I'm thinking, like, how does a client know when to mix that in, when to be working with that? And again, that's the beauty of these sort of, again, the word you don't like is recipes, but it gives you the tool. I think it gives you, allows that client to kind of think, all right, what do I do here? Oh, that's right, because I have this tool, this kind of way of thinking of that moment for that particular dog, and then shifting as that dog needs it based on what the dog is telling you.
Yeah. And it's not that I don't like recipes, it's that I don't follow them very well. So,
so neither do I. So
when I first cook something, I might have the recipe and I might follow it that first time or I might not, but I do look up the recipe to sort of know what should it really basically have in it.
Yeah, but the end goal is to make cupcakes, right?
Exactly. If you end up with cupcakes, it's good. Yeah.
So we were joking before in the beginning of the episode about traveling and stuff. And one of the things that was happening is you and I were actually touring around the country in the U.S. at the time. We didn't know we were touring with each other. But every single time I would go somewhere, you had presented there. I would be presenting with Trish, our defensive handling workshop. And you had been there a week or two earlier. And so everybody's practicing their bat leash handling skills and watching people walk in with long lines and stuff. And then I show up.
Oh, no.
I always have to preface it with okay, so there's places where Grisha's leash skills are very, very appropriate. And then I'm going to completely show you something different where that would be appropriate. So, a lot of the stuff I'm doing, of course, is defensive handling and stuff where the dog might actually bite your face off and you're working with them. So the leash is much shorter and we're using leash locks and things like that. But what are some of the core concepts in your leash skills and your leash handling, if you had to mention a couple of things that are really important?
Mm-hmm. My leash skills are really developed so that the dog So we have safety, we have controllability, so we can control the dog if we need to, and that the dog feels as free as possible. And I would say that last one is probably what distinguishes the bat leash skills from a lot of other styles. Several of the skills came in through T-Touch. So there's different places where the skills were developed. So not all by me, they're partially just assembled. But essentially, I use a 15-foot line. You more than 15 is usually hard for people to handle, so about 5 meters if you're elsewhere. And I make it so I teach the people how to, you know, how to not drop the leash, how to not tangle on the leash if the dog were to pull suddenly, how to hold on to it, all the different ways to, you know, that it can be messed up, essentially. So preventing that.
So really similar to a lot of the foundational information you just mentioned, like the dog not feeling restricted and, you know, keeping safety in mind. It's very similar to what I do. You know, I always mention loose leashes, you know, tight leashes are your enemy, I should say. They're one of the worst things that can happen to dogs that are experiencing the issues that you and I work with. So,
yeah,
interesting. And I also have to give credit, you know, everything that I've learned has mostly come from somebody else I've learned it from. I've just happened to put it all together into one seminar that's easier instead of researching to all these other places. So I do want to give credit to all the trainers that have come before me.
We stand on the shoulders of giants.
Yes, absolutely. Puppies. What about puppies? You have a chapter in your book about puppies and what to do there. And how does that apply? So like bats, you're thinking, when you're usually thinking bat, you're thinking of dogs that already have like these existing issues of reactivity or something. But what about puppies?
So it's definitely versatile in the fact that it can be used for all kind of layers of socialization. And so I definitely love using it for puppies. And interestingly, when I wrote the first bat book, I wrote a chapter on puppies, and then it's revised in the new one. And I realized that the way that I did bat for puppies is now how I do bat for everyone, essentially. With puppies, it allows them to experience their world in a safe way right from the get-go, or safer way, right? We can't completely bubble wrap it, but and it teaches the handler right away to start paying attention to body language, which is probably the most important part of the whole process, paying attention to the needs of the animal and, you know, their space needs, how to hold them back if they were to go after another dog, but mostly how to keep other dogs from harassing them or people or whatever else. And just to give time, because I think people don't really give puppies enough time to experience their world. We're kind of on our own agenda. And so teaching people to, you know, don't just go as far as you can possibly go on your walk before you have to sprint back. Go, you know, be really mindful of your time so you have time for the dog to explore even on the way back, for example.
How about, so it's really being your dog's advocate or your puppy's advocate, it sounds like. Really being careful not to push that dog into places or environments where something really scary or event like that can happen. How do you balance that when you have a question from somebody like, well, how do I know when to expose my dog to more, you know, treacherous environments or environments where it might be, I want to try to take the dog to the beach where there's a lot of people or the kids or things that could be frightening to a puppy. What do you say there? Like, how do you balance when to push it?
So one thing that I love that Susan Friedman pointed out about bat is that we always protect the exit route. So that's something that we're really mindful of in bat. And so as we do allow the dog to be in more and more sort of scary situations, you could say, or more and more realistic situations, because we think that they can handle it, we always make sure to preserve that exit route. And we make sure that they know how to use it. And so if you were to take the dog to the beach and you're not sure, you know, how many dogs might be there or whatever, it might be that you approach the beach and you go back to the car and you go home, or it might be that you do that just back to the car and then back to the beach again, and just really sort of teach the dog, yep, we're here, but we're not going to be surrounded by dogs, and making sure that you're not really putting yourself in a situation where the dog doesn't have an out. Now, eventually that may just happen, right? Because off-leash dog runs up, they don't have an exit at that point. And so teaching them maybe to go around behind you so that you can protect their exit route from that direction. But in terms of how do we know, I'm thinking of this specific time with my dog Bean when I realized, like, okay, he's done with the setups. Like, we're good now. And that was kind of completely by accident. So we had gone to not a dog park, but a park where there are off-leash dogs. And I was always, it was at the point where he could handle off-leash dogs, of course, but not that they would just, like, run up to him or tackle him. And so this one dog just sprinted directly at his face. And I was like, oh my God, because I thought it was an old dog at first. So I was just completely not prepared. And then Bean just handled it beautifully. He just, like, you know, went into a play bow. The other dog went away. He chased the dog. And then, you know, kind of started to be like, okay, I'm tired of this dog. And I had the people call their dog away. But he handled it like a normal dog who was just a little bit annoyed, instead of a dog who's like, I'm going to bite your face the moment I see you because you're a dog. So that transition was great.
So just,
I don't know if that answers your question though.
Yeah, absolutely. And just, you know, really just matters. What matters most is teaching clients or recognizing when the dog wants out and knowing when that signaling is coming, or knowing when your dog is communicating that and preserving that. I think it's, if we focused on that rather than what we need to push, but rather recognizing when that dog needs the out, that can save us a lot of trouble in the long run, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, that's totally it.
Yeah. Fascinating. So, Grisha, thank you for coming on the show. Where can people find more about what you're doing now? I know we've just done, or we're actually during the recording of this podcast, you and I are doing a little joint collaboration on intra-household dog-dog aggression, which people can still sign up for probably when this show airs. And I'm working two different cases of intra-household dog-dog aggression in the home. And that's one little project you got going on. But you just launched your new site. You want to tell people about that?
Yeah. And also your dog-human aggression course is on there as well.
That's right. Yeah.
So, which was similar, working with two cases. So my new site is grisha.thinkific.com. It's also, you can get there from just going to my main website, which is where everything will live eventually, which is grishastewart.com. And my school is it's a membership site, but you can also buy things individually. Just depends on kind of how people are, you know, what suits your learning style better. But essentially, my goal with this site was to make it so that people could access all of the material I have without having to sort of choose between, oh, I can't afford this one or this one. So I just have a flat membership fee. People can attend anything for $29 a month is the current rate. That may change because it's a really good value, especially as I've added Michael. I have Susan Friedman talking in a month and a half. I've got Dante Camacho is teaching a holistic reactivity course soon, and I really love his work. He's based on his focus is to really get the foundations, the fundamentals of, so for like a month before he does anything with aggression, he's working on just real relaxation. So I love the work that he does. Anyway, we have a photography class, how to take pictures of your dog, all kinds of fun things. And one of the things that I'm actually going to start adding on there I have a singing lesson that I take anyway. And so I'm going to just start sharing that on the site because it's just kind of fun. And since extra classes don't cost people money, then they can just attend that for free. But you can also always buy individually if membership doesn't appeal. So it's, my books are on there. All kinds of things.
Fantastic value, really. Membership is such a great deal for all the things you're getting on there. So, and you're going to keep adding to it, right? You're just going to keep adding.
You're just going to keep adding. Yeah. So lots of live things and all the recordings that are in there too. And then there's one new project that I'm sort of embarrassed to say, but it's such a fun project. So it'll be a class eventually, or maybe a webinar, but, so I've been doing contact improv dancing with my dog, and I haven't taught it to anybody else and their dogs. I have no idea if it's going to work, but I think it will. And so, yeah.
What is contact improv dancing for those that don't know?
So contact improv is, so when humans do it, it's kind of like So the idea is that you stay in contact the entire time, and then you can dance however you want to. And usually you're just kind of flowing around like amoebas sort of on the ground. And it's sort of gymnastics. It's sort of, anyway, you can, it's just, the point is that the two people stay in contact. And so now with my dog, I noticed that she really likes to do it as well. So I'm touching some part of her body, and she is the one that also keeps the contact. Part of contact improv is that there's no grabbing, there's no pulling, there's no holding on. And we're just sort of moving around the room with her staying in contact with me, and or me staying in contact with her, however you, it's both of us. So it's really fun.
Yeah, I can see and the application.
You
can do it to
music
too,
if you're so inclined. Yeah, right?
Well, you got to do it to music.
I would. With humans, you do it. And so you just make sure it's not so loud to scare the dog.
But actually, I can actually see how that lets you be more in tune with how reading your dog, seeing how your dog interacts with you, getting a fun way of playing and interacting with your dog. Yeah, there's lots of, I'm already brainstorming those applications, so that's great.
Nice. Maybe you'll be my first student.
Listen, I don't mind. I could try that for sure. I like dancing.
Cool. So,
all right. Well, Grisha, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, and I hope to see you in person at some point in the future once this whole pandemic thing goes away.
Yes, definitely. Well, maybe even the because I'm going to your Aggression, so I'll be speaking not at this one, but next one, right?
Grisha will be speaking at Aggression in Dogs Conference in 2021, so looking forward to that.
So maybe we could do that in person. Yeah, that would be nice.
I hope so. All right. Thank you, Grisha.
Thanks, Mike. Yep.
Thanks for joining me for The Bitey End of the Dog. If you like the show, please feel free to subscribe, share, or give a rating to the episode. And don't forget to hop on over to aggressivedog.com or the Loose Leash Academy for more information about webinars, courses, and conferences, all dedicated to helping dogs with aggression issues.